This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. We talked about a story that placed Britain fourth in a sort of league table for the number of people using antidepressants, league table within Europe. We were in fourth position. Interestingly enough, the Greeks, despite their apparent woes, were down at the bottom place. And when I started speaking to you about the number of calls, and they carried on, by the way, your emails, your texts and your tweets carried on through the weekend, we realised we had to do something. So I'm hugely grateful to Joe Hemmings, who I've spoken with in the past, just very kindly come to the studio though on this occasion. Joe's a behavioural psychologist, over 15 years' experience of dealing and working in this area. She's written a number of books on these sort of areas, and you see her regularly on television shows such as this morning, and she's in the studio with me. Joe, first off, obviously, thank you very much for coming into the studio. What is it about modern life that it would appear is making us more depressed and anxious?
I think it's partly that the pressures are on, but I think it's also that still, in spite of all that we hear, GPs are willing to hand out antidepressants pretty frequently, very regularly, even for people that show the slightest signs of anxiety. So I think it's a combination of, you know, we need to break that stress, we need to get over, manage that stress in some other way, not simply to be handed out, you know, long-term use.
And you think a bit of that is going on, unfortunately?
Sadly, I think a lot of it still goes on, yes.
OK. Now, this is almost a sort of the antithesis of how you work, isn't it? Because you're going to have to be, not hugely brief, but I'm sure in time you like to spend a lot of time with your patients or clients or whatever you might call them, and here it's going to be fairly swift, but you can offer some pointers, perhaps, for the people you're going to hear from now.
Yes, I work with cognitive behavioural therapy, and it works alongside, many times, alongside antidepressants. It isn't simply a choice of one or the other, so I want to be able to talk to people about that option for them as well.
Joe, you're going to speak with Rose in Hendon, who's hanging on the line. She was one who was a particularly moving call. Very briefly, this is a little of what we heard last week.
I was diagnosed with postnatal depression after both children. And after the first one, I was on antidepressants for a year.
What is it that depresses you?
Everything. I'm incapacitated. If the postman brings the post before a certain time and I miss something, I want to kill myself because I feel like I haven't done what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not worth anything.
Rose in Hendon, you're on the line. You're speaking to Joe Hemmings. Hello, Rose. How are you today? Very briefly for me. Are you all right?
I'm doing pretty well today. Thank you.
Talk to Joe.
Hi, Rose. Hello.
Hi.
Do you want to tell me a little bit more? I just sort of, you know, heard a little bit what you said last week, and obviously it's very distressing. I wanted to ask you, actually, about whether... how old are your children now, your youngest child now?
Two.
And are you still feeling the anxiety in the same way, the same level?
Yes. I was saying I don't know when it shifts from postnatal depression to something that I'm just supposed to expect to last for the rest of my life. But the particular things about postnatal depression, difficulty connecting with the children, that's definitely still there.
Yeah, of course. And the trouble with postnatal depression is there's such a huge pressure on you to perform brilliantly as a mother, you know, that it just makes it worse. Firstly, you should absolutely not have to have this for the rest of your life. You know, that isn't going to happen. I mean, I know you said there was a sort of wait for counselling. One of the things you could, if you looked on things like Mumsnet, if you spoke and gone onto forums, shared your experiences, sometimes that helps that sense of isolation, that you're the only one that still feels like this.
I've been on a few different online forums, and it does help, but it's a bit of a double-edged sword because all online interaction is so... It's this mix of superficial and very, very close.
There's a very good interactive site called Beating the Blues. Is that something you recognise? Which is kind of pretty straightforward, and it will, you know, it kind of takes you through some of these. I mean, you're going to have good days and bad days. It recognises, I suppose, if anything interactive can do that, some of the trigger signs that you have and helps you learn to have better days. Because what happens is, it isn't, you know, depression of any sort, postnatal or otherwise, is, you know, is episodic. It comes and goes. The only time sometimes you recognise it's getting better is when you start to have more better days than bad days, and that can creep up on you. You don't necessarily know it's happening. So looking at Beating the Blues, I think, you know, it hasn't got that scary nature, as you say, that double-edged sword of some of the forums.
I haven't heard of that one. I'm definitely going to look at that.
Okay, that's definitely worth looking at. And also, again, I know there's a wait for therapy, but something called interpersonal therapy can also help. It's a bit like CBT, but it's a little bit more focused.
Is that like group therapy?
No, it's individual therapy, but it's relatively new. You may be able to get in there a little bit faster than a CBT therapist.
Just to interrupt briefly, Jo, what I took from Rose's first call is that for a woman to be able to say she doesn't think she's a good mum, because it's the sort of total yes. opposite. We're all meant to be fantastic dads and obviously mums. Very brave for her to be able to say that. How do you approach someone who says to you, I think I'm a bad mum?
Well, it's part of postnatal depression, and this is the sort of the problem we've got. You know, you've got a chemical change, you've got a hormone change. This is what triggers in, you know, 1 out of 10 new mums what we call the baby blues. Now, the baby blues can simply be that, you know,
does
feeling
pretty
a
much
bit
every mum have blues of some sort?
To a degree. Right, we all, okay. It's a shock, a change to our sure. lifestyle. Sure. But, I mean, there's a big difference between what people call the baby blues and severe clinical depression long term, which is something that Rose seems to have. And, of course, you know, in Rose's mind, it's having this at the time when you've got 2 children, when you must feel responsible, when you've got to feel energetic, when you should be feeling enthusiastic, and all the other mums around you appear to be yes. coping brilliantly. Yes. Of course, you then think, I'm a terrible mum. The truth is, you've got a form of depression. It makes you think you're a terrible mum, a terrible wife, a terrible everything. But it's focused on the children because it's the one time we ought to be. We punish ourselves for not feeling that we motivated enough to yes. care about our children. And it's very, very typical of postnatal depression. And it really needs to be looked at regularly and not to be on tablets for sort of as long as Rose has been on.
All right, Rose, I'm going to move on unless there's one final question or observation you'd like from Joe. I've got a lot of people who want to speak. Maybe you'll check out Beating the Blues, Rose.
No, I'm going on there right now.
Take it easy, Rose. Thank you very much. Good luck, and do stay in touch. Let's talk about other matters, whatever. I want your opinions on all the stories and issues that we cover. Nick's in Brixton. You're through to Joe Hemmings. Go ahead, Nick.
Hi. Yeah, I've been on antidepressants and tranquilizers for 30 years.
OK. It's a long time.
Well, I've got a prologue to this as well. When I was 9 years of age, my mother was very neurotic and everything, and I was put into a special needs boarding school, and I was also given amitriptyline and lithium at the age right. of 9 years of age.
Oh, gosh.
For a number of years.
Which is shocking for a child, but go on, please.
And since then, I had a psychologist. Probably you might know him, I don't know. But I was under him for 12 years, and
right.
I did quite well. And he moved to another catchment, and nice. Now it's mainly GP care,
right.
and I just get repeat prescriptions all the time. I've tried to come off of them, but I've got a wife who's got psychotic episodes, and she won't take her medication.
Okay, Nick, how old are you now?
I'm coming up to 58.
Okay, and the medication you're currently on, can you tell me what that is?
Yeah, it's diazepam, nitrazepam, and citrapan or something. Yeah.
Okay, yep. And has your medication changed in the last, say, 10 years? How often do they review?
It's reviewed every year. It hasn't changed. What's going on in my home, and she won't take any medication, and she's making everyone's life hell in here. I need tranquilizers to calm me down.
And you're not seeing a psychologist at all now, Nick?
No, I saw a psychologist for 12 years.
Yeah, and then when did that stop?
I've done really well. They stopped about 4 years ago.
Because he moved into a different catchment area and you weren't given another psychologist to see?
No, I wasn't given another psychologist because they closed down the centre where I used to see him at.
I think what really distresses me sometimes is, A, that you've been on these pills for 30 years. Yes, you're being reviewed annually, which is marvellous, but you're not actually having your medication changed. So there's a little point in a review for the sake of a review. And the fact that clearly the combination for you of some sort of antidepressant and working with a psychologist was working well for you. And because of some administrative problem or concern, you're no longer having that help because he's moved away. Can you go back and see your GP, your consultant? Please ask to see a psychologist. You obviously built up a very good relationship with this guy over a considerable period of time. I mean, you're in a family where you came from a background where you were very young on these things. Your mother had it, you know, your partner. You need to have a psychologist to hear you, to listen to you, as well as simply being given antidepressants.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Jenny's in Worcester Park. Give through to Joe. Go ahead, Jenny.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Jenny.
Hi. I had a really positive experience with antidepressants. I was on them for about 5 years and came off about a year and a half ago. Basically, to cut a very long story short, I lost my house, I lost my job, I lost everything. I lost my children and I was in a pit of despair, and I was using drugs and alcohol at the time, and I couldn't cope day in, day out with not having my children with me. And I had a very supportive GP who put me on antidepressants. We tried probably about 8 before I found one that suited me. And, you know, there was a year in time when I stopped drinking and stopped using drugs, when I couldn't get out of bed, I couldn't interact with anybody. I was in such despair. And I ended up on Prozac, which was the one that suited me. It just helped me slowly be able to do things to help myself and start to interact with other people. I went to a community drug and alcohol team, and I was having counselling there and group therapy. Did a 12-step program. I slowly eased myself back into work.
So what is there a question or an observation you want from Joe, Jenny?
I just wanted to say, I think really to back up what you were trying to advise the previous caller. That,
yes, I mean, if there's a perfect antidepressant story, which sounds awful, I know, but you've got it. I mean, you've used an SSRI. You're on Prozac, which is, you know, a yes. good antidepressant to use. You're on it for 5 years, which is pretty much, you know, earlier caller, 30 years to be on something, you know, a minimum a year, 5 years is great. You know, you've done exactly, and I hope other people are listening, exactly what ought to be happening. You know, you take something relatively mild, you balance it together with therapy, you take control of your own life, you presumably learn how to drill down and break the component problems, concerns in your life in smaller pieces which are more manageable, and here you are as a huge success story of a situation where something like fluoxetine, Prozac has worked really well for you.
Jenny, thank you. Thank you for that. Can I turn to some of the texts, tweets and emails that are coming in, Joe? Someone who asks me to keep their identity anonymous, so I will respect that. Please can you advise, what can I do if CBT, which is cognitive behavioural therapy, of which you're an expert, I know, hasn't worked for dysthymia? Do you know that condition?
Yeah.
Help me now. What's dysthymia?
Well, actually, remind me what it is. It's a disease of the sort of nervous
right.
disorder.
And CBT hasn't helped this person. So where do they go next?
Well, it might not, because I think it is a sort of nervous condition,
right.
Which may... will come more from physiological than psychological source. So
right.
CBT won't always work if there is a physiological reason.
And explain how CBT effectively takes you to a better place, doesn't it? I mean, that's a hideous...
Yeah,
hideous
well, no, that's fine. In an ideal world, it absolutely does. It helps you manage your thoughts. It helps you think about your life, think of a different way of managing it. It drills down, it breaks... the overwhelming thing that people with depression have, this black dog, as Churchill called it, this overwhelming sense you can't... It's like wading through treacle physically and psychologically.
Mm.
It helps you take some of those thoughts and refocus them, redirect them. It's 4 to 6 weeks, probably, to sort of really get thinking in that way.
But typically, what sort of things... So clearly, postnatal depression, it would... work for that?
It would work for that. It works for most things, because what it does is it's on a one-to-one basis. So, you know, a psychologist or a CBT therapist will say to you, you know, we'll sort of find out what those trigger mechanisms are, what you think has caused it, what are the bad things in your life, how are you looking at those things, what makes you feel you can't change something about this. And then to sort of split them into smaller areas. For instance, with postnatal depression, for example, I mean, it's very easy for us to think, you know, just as Rose did, I'm a terrible mother, I can't do it. Mm. You know, a lot of it's hormonal, a lot of it needs talking through. Tell me the good bits of your being a mother, Rose. Tell me the things that you think you do well. Alternatively, tell me the things that you think you do badly and why you do them badly. You're comparing yourself to somebody else. We often do that. We often think everybody else appears to cope. I can't cope. That just sends you spiralling further back down into the awful lethargy that depression has. And CBT will encourage you to think outside of the overwhelming lethargy that it causes.
All right. Everyone thinks everyone's doing better than themselves, but they're not really.
Everybody, we're not. And we all get periods of stress and anxiety.
Ivan's in Beaconsfield. You're through to Joe Hemmings. Go ahead, Ivan.
Oh, hello there. Good morning.
Hi, Ivan.
Hello. I had a bad depression. I did say on last Friday on the programme, was after I gave up smoking.
Yeah.
And then I was 8 months. Well, I've been to the doctor, I've been to the counselling sections. That didn't help me, you know, much. They did prescribe me with the antidepressives, but I didn't actually take them at the end.
Sorry, can you remind me, what were you prescribed with?
With the antidepressant.
Okay, and do you know what antidepressant it was?
I can't remember.
No, don't worry, but, okay, go on.
Yeah, basically... as I said, I was reading through the side effects of it, I decided not to take it. Just felt like it would be, a bad thing for my health instead of helping me out. And basically, I suffer with it 8 months. As I said, it always started when I gave up smoking.
So it's anxiety that started when you gave up smoking.
Yeah, exactly.
And how does that anxiety show itself? I mean, you know, what happens to you?
It's difficult to describe because I had like a kind of it was like kind of something stuck on my chest and throat, you know, like, and I was coughing all the time, but that wouldn't go away.
Okay, so that's anxiety. That's the tightness of the chest, the feeling like you've got a lump in your throat, can't swallow.
Yeah.
Does actually happen quite often with nicotine withdrawal if you are quite dependent on nicotine, because it does help you relax. Did they give you an alternative or offer you any alternative to nicotine, to patches, to smoking rather, to patches?
I had them for 2 weeks, you know, but I wanted to stop for good.
Okay, because I get that. I mean, what bothers me a bit that we've gone from sort of smoking, which is a kind of common problem, people want to give up, suddenly to going on to antidepressants, which is quite the other end of the spectrum. And there should be several shades of treatment, if you like, in between these stages. I mean, the other thing I would say to you is the whole, when you read of course you must read the contraindications of any pill that you're taking, but sometimes when you read the whole thing, it has to cover, for legal reasons, every single thing you could possibly feel. And it can be a bit scary to read them. You know, if you're feeling a bit anxious, you can automatically sometimes start to feel some of the things that you've read on this list. I think back to your talk. I mean, we need to do something about your anxiety, the tightness of your chest and your throat. I don't think an antidepressant is what you need, but I'm not. You're not my patient, but right. I would suggest that you.
Then, you know, that just developed like sort of other symptoms as well. You know, I was crying a lot. You know, I was crying all the time, even for small, you know, small circumstances. You know, like I was crying a lot. You know, I was sleeping three hours per night. You know, I couldn't sleep no more than that.
Is there something else going on in your life? I know we haven't got much time for me to go into it, but is there some other trauma or?
Time. I wasn't quite happy about my job, because the job I was to do, it was quite depressive as well. You know, I was to be, I was to work for a company that they actually basically mainly they do property repossessions. You know, back for the banks. It wasn't a pleasure, you know.
Right, okay, of course.
So, but then, you know, all you know, what I've got to say, like, of course, I don't advise no one to do it, but all went away when I got back to smoke, you know, and then that
Yeah, untroubling. That unfortunately has other health issues. Of course, yep. Joe is aware, and everyone else. Ivan, again, good luck. I think you hear the advice from Joe that you need to get some medical support there. We've got time, hopefully, for one more of your so many. Vicky's in Streatham. Vicky, you're top of the queue at the moment. Go ahead, Vicky.
I was just phoning to say that I think there is a tendency by doctors to instantly say any problem that you've got after having a child is postnatal depression and sling a load of drugs at it and let them get on, rather than actually tackling possibly the reasons that are causing the depression, such as lack of appropriate support from maybe the partner or the family of the person.
Is this something you've experienced?
Yeah,
Vicky?
Totally. No, yes. I had a very, very, very unsupportive partner and a very unsupportive family when I had my first child, and then was diagnosed with postnatal depression, which I, when I was talking to the doctor, and I'm a, I have done a training in therapy, I said, I'm not depressed. Yes. I'm too angry to be depressed. I'm yes. exhausted. Like, and it's an external anger because I can see that people are not giving me the help that I need. I'm breastfeeding throughout the night. I'm up 6 or 7 times a night.
Yeah, and it's exhausting. I mean, it's physically exhausting. It's emotionally exhausting.
Well,
and the cash-strapped NHS, of course, it's very difficult for people to have that sort of counselling. But, you know, I've met so many women, you know, even the whole lover-to-mother issue, you know, the emotional change that they go through, you know, psychologically, apart from the hormones, apart from the sort of physiological changes, you know, it's massive. And in fact, you wonder how any mother really, unless they're masking it a bit, new mother manages to give off the impression that everything's splendid, you know, just had a baby, just like the celebrities, they all ping back into shape, don't they, in a nanosecond. Well, that doesn't happen to real people's bodies. So people get concerned they don't look like Victoria Beckham, you know, 5 minutes after they've given birth, or even Kate Middleton. So there's 100 reasons why women get postnatal blues, depression, and throwing tablets at it is probably the last thing you want to do.
Quick response from you, Vicky.
Can I just add that actually the NHS cannot deal with a breakdown of no family support, no partner support. There's nothing the NHS
no,
can do that.
There is nothing.
A family
yes.
dysfunction.
It's take it back home with you.
It's,
sadly.
It is also that people are not actually saying that actually women, when they've had a baby, need a huge amount of support, whereas very often they don't get it. They just get contempt.
And also on this, Vicky, thank you. Briefly, Joe, I suppose the fact that we're such a mobile population now, as opposed to we used to be, we would grow up and our grandmothers would be the other side of the town or whatever it might be. Now they're the other end of the country.
Yes, the family support's not there. I mean, there are, you know, online sites now, as I said, Mumsnet earlier, you know, that kind of thing, which we didn't have years ago. But it isn't the same as human interaction. If, like Vicky, your partner isn't as supportive as they might be, of course, you feel very isolated. It's a very lonely feeling.
Joe, thank you. Joe Hemmings is a behavioural psychologist, 15 years experience in this field. Books are out there as well. You have a website, I imagine.
I have websites, joehemmings.co.uk.
All right, thanks for coming in. We'll talk
to you
again,
I'm
sure. Coming up after the news, Nicola Sturgeon back in the news again, furious with the front page cover of a magazine. But what is it that's got her so angry? You'll find out after this. 9:31, listening to Nick Ferrari's Breakfast here on LBC. Let's get the news, Lisa Aziz.
A 79-year-old man has been stabbed to death following a car crash in West Sussex last night. It happened on the A24 at Findon just before 8:40 p.m. The suspect got out of the car in front and...
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. How comforted are you by seeing police on the streets? In reality, anyone who knows pretty much anything about policing knows that the reality of actually catching someone in the act with a beat bobby, as they are known, is very, very marginal. It's highly unlikely they're actually ever going to see anything where they can make an effective arrest. However, what they are is a visible deterrent. They give comfort to those who actually pay, of course, through their rates, who pay for the police officers. They make us feel better about ourselves. It's a good feeling to see a bobby come down the beat. But before I give you more details of the story and why this is making news at the moment, a question for you. When was the last time a police officer, or a couple of them, walked down your street? Now, I realise there may be many of you for whom you literally cannot remember. And I have now, racing down your street in police cars, yes, probably yes. Coming down just on foot, maybe not. When was the last time a police officer, you looked out the window from your home, or I'll allow your place of work as well, and saw police officers on routine patrol? Now, by the way, for me, I can say it was but weeks ago. However, they were on horses. Yes, two police officers came along my road in horses on the way to the Heath, where they exercise the police horses. So on horses, actually, I see them quite often. On foot, I cannot remember the last time. And we now learn that police on the beat are an outdated notion that should be sacrificed in favour of sophisticated policing methods to tackle online crime and adopt other major trends, according to one of the nation's most prominent police chiefs. Nick Alston is chairman of the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, and he says that neighbourhood uniform patrols had not been relevant for decades, while their impact on crime was, at the very best, completely unproven. Now, again, he is right on that, but what he does seem to be deciding to miss is how they make people feel safer. Nick Alston, as I remind you, is chairman of APCC, the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, is also the elected Tory PCC for Essex, and says that police have beats because in the old days they didn't have telephones and they didn't have cars. Those days went 50 years ago. He said he doesn't support the total abolition of neighbourhood response teams, and talks about a level of visibility, but he said that in a climate of cuts, forces need to give evidence-based policing priority. Specially trained officers who could tackle child abuse and sexual exploitation or crime on the internet were more important. He says, and I'm quoting, "The bobbies on the beat language for me is very outdated and misses the point about modern policing. We want our police officers focused where we know they can make a difference to crime reduction. I'd love other forces to learn that you don't want bobbies on the beat. You want highly trained detectives who can obtain best evidence interviews really well, who've got the skills to manage a relationship with social care so we can do the safeguarding for the children who are coming to harm." What on earth is he talking about? Why is he just talking about nicking the criminals? So, when was the last time you saw a copper come walking past your front door, or possibly even your back door? Simon Harding is a lecturer in criminology at Middlesex University, joins me now. Mr. Harding, what is the value of, if any, of Bobby's on the Beat? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Well, it's part of a traditional form of policing, really, and it's about giving community reassurance to the public that there is some kind of a social guardian there that they can call upon in times of trouble. And I hear what you've been saying, but I'm not personally convinced that the public is quite ready yet to give that up. I think there are too many benefits there. The background to this, of course, is that policing is changing. It's going through a form of professionalisation. And certainly there is a move to evidence-based policing. There's also a move towards wearing body cameras, that type of thing. So the police are going through a number of changes. But to take away the walking bobbies on the beat completely, I think might be a negative move, certainly in terms of public reassurance and how the public view the police.
And isn't that the key? Because you will know that we can only be policed if we agree by common consent to be policed. And seeing a copper or coppers, it's that engagement with us, with the public, that is so vital, keeping that relationship going.
Well, that's absolutely right, Nick. I mean, there are echoes of what happened back in the 1970s and the 1980s when many of the walking patrol bobbies moved on to patrolling in cars. Mm. And there were similar debates then about the removal of the police from interaction with the public. And it's that interaction that's absolutely vital in many cases, because it generates community intelligence, and people do approach the police and provide them with information which may not necessarily lead to a crime being solved, but it may lead to a pattern of evidence being collected, and at some point in the future that becomes important. And if you take away the patrolling policeman, that type of thing gets removed.
And when we're being urged to, certainly within certain communities, as we call them, or groups of people here, isn't it good to have coppers wandering around seeing what's going on rather than just spending their entire time going to various focused areas of research or evidence or driving around in cars?
Oh, yes, Nick, I absolutely agree. I think it's vital. You have to remember there are many, many different types of communities, especially in London. And there are some communities that are still reluctant to approach the police. And certainly that's the case in terms of reporting crime. So, for example, when they engage with the police on the street, or they visibly see that their areas and their neighbourhoods are being patrolled, I think that's a benefit both to these diverse communities and to the police themselves. So I understand that police are changing, and I think that's a good thing. But I'm not certain that that would be a move in the right direction.
Lastly, in a sentence, how important are PCSOs in this particular part of the conversation? They do give visibility, don't they?
Well, yes, they do. They are highly visible. They manage to take away from the main regular police force a number of operational activities that they would otherwise be engaged in. So they're very much the eyes and the ears, I think, of the police force at the moment. Though what I understand is there's some uncertainty about their future.
Thanks for that. Simon Harding, lecturer in criminology at Middlesex University. Actually, we'll come to you, David, so we can have a proper amount of conversation. We'll come to that in just a second. Also, as I've mentioned before, so David, you'll be the first caller. As I mentioned before, where is the part of the country where they're going to give a guarantee no potholes? Hundreds of miles of road, but how exactly they're going to do it, and possibly where is it going to be done? Let's get talking about this idea of whether or not there should be bobbies on the beat. David's in Enfield. When did you last see a police officer walk past your front door? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick.
Yeah.
The policeman walked past my front door, but I was in my local library in Enfield yesterday, and the police visited the library, as they do regularly during the week.
Police came to the library, did you say?
Yeah, there's been a few problems with unruly youths in the library.
Oh, right.
And so the police now come regularly just to check that everything's okay.
Right.
And the librarians aren't being given any lip. But in Enfield, generally, the high street in Enfield, the main commercial area, the policing is excellent.
Why? You know, what makes it excellent?
Well, because there's high visibility, community services officers and constables in uniform. There was a problem with a car the other day, and within about 4 or 5 minutes, there were five officers on foot who were attending the incident. I've seen people being arrested after stop and search by officers on foot. And I think it's very important. I think not so much in the residential areas, because there are cars patrolling, but I think in a commercial area which has a high density of people, with all these threats now of terrorism incidents, I think that it gives the public confidence,
yes,
to see the uniformed officers on foot, especially in London. You have millions of tourists, and, you know, you have the real possibility of these incidents.
Let me ask you this. Do you think PCSOs give the same level of confidence as well?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think anybody in a uniform, I mean, they're all connected. They're all working for the same group, and they're all connected by radio. So, I mean, if the PCS has a problem, you're going to have full-time uniformed officers there pronto, at least in Enfield. And I can't compliment the Enfield Police Service enough for the job they do.
Well, you just have, David. Thank you. I'm sure they'd be delighted to hear it. Kevin's in Guildford. Kevin, your reaction. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I'm Nick Alston's opposite number in Surrey, the Police and Crime Commissioner.
Oh, yes.
Nick, I come on often with you, as you know, Nick. Nick Alston, sadly, is stating the facts. Because there are such huge cutbacks now in police funding, we've already lost 17,000 officers nationwide, with probably another 20,000 to go. Our first priority is to answer the emergency calls for the public, then try and investigate offences when they happen, as well as put some extra people onto tasks like child exploitation, fraud and terrorism. There just isn't anyone left in the box to do the Bobby on the beat stuff. And I think it's a vitally important role. For all the reasons you yourself said earlier on, I completely agree with every point you made, Nick, and in fact, every one of these callers, but actually there just isn't any money. I went out on Saturday...
You say that, but, you know, the papers are full of where the police can find time to arrest someone for plugging his iPhone into a train, or a man who gave a pound coin to someone because they thought it was a drug deal, or a father who had a certain slogan on his T-shirt, or a man who took a photograph of a police vehicle in a no-parking area. They managed to muster two cars to chase him down. It's always there when they need to, isn't it?
Yeah, they're always one-off kind of little incidents.
Well, I just did four, Kevin.
Make a headline. Second.
I just did four. Two police cars scrambled because someone had the nerve to take a picture of a Metropolitan Police van parked in a no-parking bay. A man being arrested because of his T-shirt. Sorry, being visited because of a T-shirt. A man arrested because he plugged his iPhone into the train. And a man being arrested because he gave a pound to a beggar. I mean, the cops have got a lot of time on their hands if they can do all of this.
Well, there's 365 days in a year. You divide that up between 50-odd forces around the country. You can easily find the odd anomaly. The fact is, and Saturday night for me was a real example. I went out as a politician now on patrol with a single crude cop. And we were driving from one side of the county to another, answering calls that frankly should have had a much bigger response, because there just isn't any staff. I mean, I really would like, in Surrey, to be able to put more officers on the beat, but we can't put enough staff on our child exploitation team. We can't cybercrime. The bottom line, Nick, is cuts have consequences. When you take several billion out of the budget, this is what happens. It's sad. I loved it. I used to be one. But we are where we are, and unless we change the way we finance the police, this is what's going to happen.
Kevin, thank you. Jason in Raynes Park. When did you last see a bobby, Jason?
Morning, Nick.
Hello.
All right. I'm quite lucky round here, I think. I see them most mornings, and I say hello, and it's sort of like you talk to them now. Because you see that I see them more often. You might get one of each, you know, a proper copper and another one.
Do you mean a PCSO?
That's it. But they're polite. But what does me is, you know, everybody's saying, oh, we should be doing terrorism, we should be doing this, that and the other. But surely it starts at the ground level. And this is where, if you see police, it puts people off. And then things don't escalate because there's police on the ground.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
A diminished BBC would simply mean a diminished Britain, they say, in an open letter. You always know you've gone bonkers when you start sending open letters, I think. Signed by more than two dozen figures from the world of arts and entertainment. The letter echoes language used by the BBC DG, Director General Lord Hall, who's previously warned the government is looking to diminish the corporation. More from Lord Hall in just a moment. But when I say to you, the BBC, for many of a certain generation, or certainly for our parents, this was the BBC.
Here is an illustrated summary of the news. It'll be followed by the latest film of events and happenings at home and abroad.
So somehow it's become this.
Winner of The Voice 2015 is...
Stevie!
So when I say just those three letters, so much a part of our lives, BBC, what goes through your mind? What does it stand for? And do you think, and the government is certainly not hanging around, is it, in this term? It is reported, getting ready possibly to diminish the corporation. Let's speak with Rod Little, former senior editor at the BBC. He's now a Sun columnist. Don't miss his column. It's fantastic every Thursday. It's one you really want to read, along with Kelvin McKenzie. I better say a word about Uncle Kelvin as well. He's a commentator and author as well. Rod, what does the BBC mean to Britain? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. It means an awful lot to Britain. But in terms of that open letter, the greatest diminishing that will take place is in the salaries of the people who sent it. They all work for the BBC and get enormous amounts of money from the BBC. And that's one of the problems that the BBC's got, isn't it? You know, it is penuried whenever it pays Chris Evans £2 million, because a lot of people don't like Chris Evans, and a lot of people do. So it's always got that horrible dichotomy that it's got to sort out somehow.
What's your take on the approach you've seen by the new Culture Secretary, John Whittingdale, and the appointment of this panel that who are going to opine on the future of the BEEB?
Well, it's difficult. Something needs to be done with the BBC. A lot of the BBC's problems are of its own making, of course. I mean, it's not its fault that it can no longer compete for the really, really big sporting events, which were other things which, you know, you and I would have watched football, you know, England international yep. football on the BBC. And we would have gone to the BBC first every time. And so, you know, so it is with the Ashes as well. And they're priced out of the market on all that stuff. And it's nothing to do with the BBC being useless particularly. It's to do with the fact that, you know, the broadcasting medium has changed. There's so many other far more expensive channels around, you know, that it just cannot punch its weight. So something needs to be done with it. Now, I think probably the BBC is heading in the right the government is heading in the right direction, because there's no will within the BBC to actually concentrate on what it does best and to think about what it does best, because it's moved into so many new areas as a consequence of the change in medium.
Let me ask you this, as someone who worked there and in a fairly senior level, how much has the BBC in the past, not necessarily so much now, been guilty of a sort of statist groupthink?
I don't know about statist groupthink. What the BBC tends to do, in terms of its bias, for example, which we all talk about, the bias of the BBC shows, it seems to be a bias towards the establishment, not the government, but the establishment. You know, at the moment, it's a liberal elite establishment, and that's the bias which the BBC shows, and it's sort of always done that. You know, the bias it showed in the 60s and 70s was probably towards the right a little bit, because the establishment was then towards the right. And it's certainly a bubble, the BBC. The people in it just do not understand how life works outside the BBC. You know, you hear people like Danny Cohen. I've forgotten what is
controller of TV, I think, wasn't he? Or he was, certainly, yeah.
Controller of the known universe, thinking he could get double his salary in the private sector. Mm. You know, this enormous. Go on, give it a go then, mate, and see how you get on.
Great speaking with you, Rod Liddle. Keep up the great work in The Sun, where you catch him every Thursday. He's also a blogger for The Spectator. You'll catch him in the Taser, busy one, and he's a former BBC executive as well. Just let me give you some of the figures behind the BBC, right? £21.5 million rise in the BBC's wage bill. 54 is the number of staff who receive six-figure payoffs, totalling £6.95 million. There are 74 BBC employees who earn more than the Prime Minister. 74. There's an increase of 31 in senior managers on more than £100,000 a year. And the talent bill is up 7% at £208 million. Surely John Whittingdale, the Culture Secretary, and for that matter the Prime Minister, David Cameron, is right to say that there needs to be a fairly hefty review of how the BBC operates. The government already compelling the BBC to fund TV licences for the over 75s. That's cost £650 million. Mike's in Gosport on this. Hello, Mike.
Hi. On so many levels, I don't want to see the BBC diminished too much. I know it's got to draw its horns in.
But it won't, will it?
I know you're anti-licence, but I worry about commercials for a start. You know, going down that road, it's the one oasis where I can watch a TV programme without being asked if I want a PPI loan evaluation every 10 minutes.
But the way, let me tell you how I'd do it. There will be certain parts of it that would remain ad-free. And I think the World Service is actually something that's probably quite useful. But are you really going to tell me that your world would come to an end if one of the actors on EastEnders picked up a glass or a cup of Maxwell House or Nescafe? How would that bother you?
Of course, that wouldn't bother me at all, but you're missing the point. It's balkanised now, broadcasting. There are hundreds of channels on the Sky satellite. Mm. Hardly any of them can afford to make a decent programme because the advertising revenue is so fragmented. There are loads of things that the BBC does that nobody else would do if it were to diminish too much.
Yeah, but hold on, no one else would do it because no one cares about the output. So it's completely non-commercial. BBC Three, BBC Four,
like The Voice and Strictly. You're defeating your own argument there. The
output, well, respectfully, I'm not.
Inform and entertain and look after all the millions of people at home who want something decent. If there were no BBC, we'd be watching American import dramas all the time because
nobody else
can afford to do it.
Which are absolutely brilliant. Shows like Veep.
Yes, they are in their own way.
And Breaking Bad. These are amazing.
I don't want to see things like Sherlock and all the other great British dramas.
But don't you see, if they work, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example. Sherlock, you'll have a pack of Rossmann cigarettes or something. I don't know, I don't smoke. But there'll be something that you can put on the telly that Sherlock can do.
He can add a pinprick to the budget.
Well, I don't know. All right, well, let them to make some programmes. But why do I have to pay for The Voice?
Because 7 million people like it. I don't, but you might like, I don't know, you might like listening to the subsidised Radio 3. You probably watch BBC News.
I don't, I watch Sky. I watch very little. My life would not be gravely impacted if the BBC was cut radically back. I don't listen or watch to it that much.
Some other people's would, though.
Well, that's tough. Mike, we'll talk soon. Look after yourself. Thank you. More reactions on that. I ran through some of those numbers, by the way. What do you suppose the car allowance is over at the BBC? If your job means you get a car allowance, how much can you claim? Do you suppose it's £3,000, £13,000 or £18,000 per annum? The 54 of the staff received six-figure payoffs. They were worth nearly £7 million. There are 74 employees over there who make more than the Prime Minister. And I do think that's a fair yardstick by which you can judge folk. There are 31 more senior managers on more than £300,000 last year. So the pay packets have gone, despite being told and saying that they had pulled their horns in, they've gone completely the other way. And that car allowance. So, I mean, the money's flowing around over there, all of which we pay them, right? So every day when they get up, the money's got to come in or we all go to jail. And if they can claim a car, they can pick up an extra, I asked, was it £13,000 or £18,000 in their skyrocket? It's £13,000 extra. Boom, in your skyrocket. Sorry, did you qualify for a car? Would you rather have the cash? Okay, £13,000 a year. Fantastic, isn't it? A little bit more of that letter signed from... I mean, there are some good people among the signatures. Gary Lineker, Claudia Winkleman, Michael Palin. There are some others, of course. Stephen Fry. I sort of could make it a rule of life that whatever Stephen Fry and Sir Lenny Henry oppose is probably a good thing, and whatever they support is probably a bad thing. I've not really gone wrong much with my view on that.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.